ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In 2007, a charismatic Englishman who ran a doomsday cult from his living room in WA vanished with his partner, their child, and a friend.
He asked me what planet I was from.
He's a very odd guy.
Something wasn't right.
I'm Dominique Bayens, host of the new season of Expanse, The Nanup 4, where we dive into a murky world of cults, control, and secret identities. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the Middle East, as war spreads and intensifies, Operation Epic Fury has, for now, drowned out any whisper of diplomacy.
For now, but where do onlookers like Europe, say, stand amongst the chaos? Where does the hard power begin and end? And might there be a gear shift inside?
This episode, we take the view of a veteran American observer in Berlin and why he thinks the war could be over as soon as next week.
I'm Geraldine Doogue.
And I'm Latika Burke. This is Global Roaming.
Yes, Latika, it's sort of just keeping up with the various bits of speculation, let alone the actual sort of the events of the war is definitely a full-time job at the moment. I don't know, is there sort of blanket coverage in your neck of the woods?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this war has taken everything else off the front pages, including and particularly Ukraine, which I think is a bit of a worrying development, given there are very real links between these two wars. And yet the reasoning for going to war in Iran could equally apply to what Putin is doing in Ukraine. And yet the responses are so very, very different, Geraldine.
Yes, I know. We'll talk about Ukraine in this episode, which is a very depressing part of the whole thing. It's very interesting how different angles are emerging, like the threat to drinking water in the Gulf. There was an American strike against a desal plant in Iran and an Iranian strike, a small-scale strike, on the Gulf. And everybody is trying to say, look, that is just absolute no-go zone. You know, it's against the rules of war, international rules of war, but of course it doesn't seem to matter these days. So I think there are strands that are going to emerge in all of this that we haven't predicted.
What I'm really interested to find out this episode, Geraldine, is how the reactions to what Trump and Israel are doing in Iran is splitting where there have been previously coherent responses on the use of military force or the use of standing up to tyrants in the region. This is completely different. And I'm really interested to find out how lasting some of these splits are, and also domestically then what they do to leaders who have not navigated this well.
It's exploded in such a way that I think there are huge shifts, a similar level to the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989, underway there in that region. And most people are not ready for this, which makes our guest a perfect choice, a chief diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times covering Europe, based in Berlin, Stephen Erlanger. He actually did cover the Iranian Revolution, believe it or not, as a cub reporter in 1979, and has been posted to many bureaus around the world, including Jerusalem. So here he is now, Stephen Erlanger. Stephen Erlanger, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you. It's great to be here virtually.
Look, as this war rolls on, what are the key shifts in relations between allies and the United States? What's changing more than you predicted, or not changing?
Well, this war was started without much recourse to allies except Israel. I mean, there wasn't a lot of forewarning. They didn't talk to the American people very much, President Trump, let alone to the two European allies or Asian allies, even though the war was bound to have an impact on the global economy and on oil supplies and energy prices. They thought, kind of like Putin did going into Kiev, it would be over quickly, I think. They planned for something longer. And anyone who saw the buildup of American power in the region over 2 weeks or 2.5 weeks would not be surprised that the war began. But I think there was a lot of misconception in Washington about how it would go. Not sure why. So allies, I think, were quite offended by the breaking of international law because this was not a response to any particular real threat. But at the same time, were ambivalent because no one loves the Iranian Islamic regime, which had just murdered thousands of its own people, up to 10,000, if not more, which has threatened death to Israel for 47 years, which has been the author of terrorism in America, in Argentina, all over the Middle East, which sponsored Hamas, the Houthis, Hezbollah. I mean, this is a dangerous regime, and which had been building up enough highly enriched uranium that would be enough for 10 bombs if they could deliver them. So no one's weeping for the Islamic Revolution, but people are ambivalent about being cast to, in a way, favor a war that they don't really like, that they thought was unnecessary, and that has great risks, I think.
Well, that's what intrigues me in terms of lasting impact. I mean, this is speculation, I realise that. But for instance, relations with Europe and especially the United Kingdom and that so-called special relationship with sort of wording that is being used by President Trump towards the Prime Minister in England is quite extraordinary. I just wonder, you know, how you see the lasting change.
Well, it's quite insulting and even childish. I mean, Trump's a bully. And Trump loves to insult people. He's insulted Macron. He's insulted almost everyone you could think of. He was angry with Keir Starmer, first over the Chagos Islands, so he's going back and forth. Then he was angry because Starmer wouldn't let him use Diego Garcia as a base to launch this war because, frankly, Britain wasn't consulted and does believe the war is probably illegal under international law, and then got embarrassed because Trump called them out. And now once British bases on Cyprus have been missiled and droned, like the French, the British have said, you can use our bases for defensive purposes, whatever that is in a war, and to defend our allies in the Gulf. So there's been a lot of ambivalence. I think part of the political reluctance in Europe, too, I have to say, is the sense that the United States is going to war as much for Israel as for itself. And after what's happened in Gaza, I think there's a lot of political ambivalence in Europe to be associated with this war.
Is it just Israel, Stephen, or does Iraq and the specter of what happened there still hang so heavy across Europe, particularly the British Labour Party?
Precisely. And obviously Tony Blair got sucked into this war, believing, I think, sincerely that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. It turned out not to be the case. And Blair's reputation, which was quite high, never recovered, hasn't recovered since. So it is a neuralgic point for the Labour Party not to get sucked into another American war in the Middle East on a perhaps shaky pretext. That's putting it politely.
I wonder whether there are a range of people in the administration who are playing roles in this. Is it just Trump and I will come to Hegseth soon, and Rubio, and obviously the military, or are there other key people behind the scenes that whom you sense are playing a considerable role one way or the other? What's your judgment?
Well, it's always a debate, right? I mean, even in the Trump White House, there's a debate. I mean, it's a serious thing to go to war. And the vice president, J.D. Vance, was quite reluctant. I mean, he argued against the war, as I understand it, but was obviously going to go along with the president. I think the timetable got accelerated by the chance to kill off the supreme leader and by Israel's impatience. And yet they didn't do that much to protect American troops in the region. They did almost nothing to tell American citizens to get out of the way. one had the sense of a fairly rapid decision to go, though the preparation for the decision was taking some time. And then there's the debate about what kind of war. I mean, would it be fast? Would it not be fast? How much to participate with Israeli aims. I think you see American and Israeli aims already diverging to some degree. But there was a debate, and they didn't talk to Congress much either. I mean, this really was quite extraordinary. I mean, even, you know, before we went into Iraq, there was a long preparation of the American public and debates in Congress and discussion of weapons of mass destruction and so on and so on. Here, there was nothing. It was like suddenly one woke up on a Saturday morning and off we went.
I want to come back to that Saturday morning because two things became immediately clear. There were leaders, and I think quite surprising in who they were, who very swiftly backed in Donald Trump. They were Labor Prime Minister in Australia, Anthony Albanese, and Mark Carney in Canada. And notably, Europe has stuck behind international law. As we've discussed, it has the Iraq specter hanging over it still. Do you think the world is dividing into powers that recognize the reality of hard power and the world we're in, and those who still think international law can and should matter?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think, you know, Steve Walt wrote a very good essay for Foreign Affairs talking about a kind of predatory imperialism on the part of the United States. Trump's sense of the world has always been very different. He keeps saying the only law he obeys is that of his own stomach. Hegseth goes out saying no silly rules of engagement. And it makes other NATO allies very nervous, partly. Go back to Davos and Greenland. I mean, Trump's extraordinary speech in Davos, where basically he said, I'm going to take Greenland from Denmark, whether they like it or not, essentially. And that prompted some European pushback, which hit the markets, which affected Trump and calmed him down a bit. But I think it had a lasting impact. And Davos was also where Mark Carney gave this speech, which I think was overpraised, but in which he talked about the old order's over, fine, and that there was a great rupture, and that the middle powers should somehow work together. That's easier said than done. But the Europeans, to be sure, I think they're built on post-World War II understandings of international law, i.e. no border changes without everyone agreeing, nothing by violence, shared sovereignty, multilateral institutions. I mean, what is the EU but this extraordinary experiment in shared sovereignty? Maybe it was, you know, last century's great success. I'm not sure it's a model other people are following. But Europeans are holding to it because international law is what protects small powers from big powers. And that's what the European Union is. It's a collection of basically mid-size and smaller countries who've banded together to protect themselves against larger, more predatory powers. So we're shifting back to a world of predation.
But by that metric, I would have assumed Canada and Australia would go straight into that European basket, wouldn't you?
Well, I would have to some degree, but there's national security at stake too. I think Carney felt he'd thumbed his nose at Trump probably sufficiently. I mean, there are serious economic ties at stake. And, you know, Australia is part of Five Eyes. It's very strong, important security and intelligence relationship with the United States that should not be willing to break, I think, and has to be careful about. And I think Australia's security, to a large degree, still depends on the American nuclear deterrent and on the Navy and so on. So if you're worried about China, as Australia often is, then I think you don't want to really rupture with with the United States, particularly for a war that's pretty far away from you.
Yes, it's a very interesting trying to work out how the Australian government is thinking, Stephen. I mean, what if it actually does go faster, as various sort of contributors around the world are saying? This whole war could move faster for all sorts of reasons. Might some leaders actually want to, they're hedging their bets slightly in terms of whether it does achieve outcomes that put the region on a different trajectory?
Yes, well, I think that's true. And I believe that, you know, what's happened since October 7th and the changes in the Middle East generally, this being only the last chapter so far, is as important as what happened when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989. It changes the givens. It changes the assumptions. I mean, Iran, whatever emerges from Iran, Iran will be much weakened, more chaotic. There's likely to be more elite struggle inside the country. It'll be much more wrapped up in its own self than in the rest of the region. You have Israel ascendant militarily. You have Lebanon with a chance to restore sovereignty and control over the south. You have Assyria that's very different, that has a chance to be a relatively more normal country. And you have a Gulf which was trying to live with this nuclear-capable Iran, which is now, I think, has relations very much strained. So, you know, basically the dice are up in the air. I really do think these changes are important and lasting, even if we can't perceive all of them right now. And I think you're right that some people would like the Islamic revolution to fall quickly, but the worry is of a chaotic Iran with loose nukes all over again, right? And if the regime survives, and survival is a victory, then there will be an argument, perhaps already happening, that the military-influenced government that survives will race for a bomb as the best deterrent against any future attack, rather than hold to the fatwa that the first Ayatollah Khamenei said, which was that Iran would never have the bomb. So Iran's misread the situation badly, but so has the United States. And the risks, I think, of nuclear proliferation now are as high as they've ever been.
Does a U.S. victory, can it only mean that the U.S. derides Iran of that ability to create a bomb? And in doing so, that would mean sending in troops to secure those supplies?
Well, that's a debate, but it's going to be a very dangerous thing to go do. I mean, Iran's a big country and it has soldiers on the ground. You know, I keep going back to before many of your listeners would remember, but when Jimmy Carter tried to rescue the American hostages by sending troops into Iran secretly, and it collapsed in a place called Taba and was a great disaster and helped pull down Carter's presidency. So these are very dangerous missions. I think what could happen, one doesn't know, one could happen. Trump is already beginning to talk about how we've accomplished pretty much our aims. Israel doesn't feel that way, but Trump could declare victory tomorrow very easily and say, look, you know, we've destroyed their military, we've destroyed their navy, we've really obliterated the nuclear effort this time. We have a new government that is willing to discuss in a very serious way a different kind of treaty on its nuclear ambitions, and we've done our job. And you know, let's all go home. Now, the Israelis have a different view. They really want the regime completely dismantled. They don't really care what takes its place, frankly.
Are you convinced of that, by the way? Because that was exactly going to be my next question. What do you think the Israeli aim is here? And given that they are so penetrated into that country, I've been wondering myself, you know, what do they know? What do they know about what's happening behind the scenes, particularly among those elites?
Well, I think they know a lot. And one of the interesting questions is whether they will go after Mojtaba Khamenei, the new supreme leader. Some people suggest that, you know, there are people in Iran who are actually thinking more about who would succeed Mojtaba if he gets killed for a future government. No, I think Israel wants to dismantle the regime in its entirety. I think an Iran that is chaotic, that's wrapped up in its own troubles, that's trying to restore itself, that is not able to influence the region, not able to help Hezbollah, not able to help the Houthis, not able to help Hamas, would please Israel very much. I think that's really their aim here.
And is there a candidate that would lead that sort of, is there a candidate Israel would ideally like to work with to lead Iran?
I don't know the answer to that, frankly. Now, maybe the Mossad knows and the CIA must know something. But I keep remembering I covered the Iran Revolution as a young journalist in 78, 79. And the U.S. spent all its time, the CIA, studying the Shah and everyone around the Shah. And they knew who was sleeping with whom. And of course, the revolution took them completely by surprise because they hadn't studied the madrasa. They hadn't studied the Islamists. And even during the revolution, they thought the merchants would win, the bazaaris would win. So, you know, life has all kinds of surprises.
Stephen, how do you think this factors into a breakthrough for Ukraine?
Well, I've been thinking quite a lot about that, honestly. Ukraine depresses me terribly just because we're in a weird stalemate. Trump does seem to buy the Putin narrative, but isn't really pushing it right now very hard. I think Ukraine's suffering from the amount of air defense missiles being used in the Middle East right now, in the Gulf, and by American forces, because I think Zelensky said the other day that more Patriot missiles have been fired so far in this war than Ukraine has been able to fire in 4 years. So that's telling, I think. So the Russians are not making much ground, and it's a very scary front line. The Ukrainians have actually won some ground back, but the movement is so small. And the Europeans keep promising to, you know, their commitment to Ukraine, money will be there, they'll buy weapons from the United States. But the problem is Europe has no strategy to end the war. Their only hope is that Trump will put enough pressure on Putin to convince Putin he's won enough to stop. But Trump doesn't seem terribly interested in doing that. And you have, in the meantime, Russia having no compunction about trying to clobber Ukrainian civilian infrastructure, heating plants, power plants, while Ukraine is doing its best to hammer Russia's energy production facilities. So I don't really see an end. I mean, it's taken attention away from that. It's taken attention away from Gaza. I mean, and you know, maybe it's also taken for Trump attention away from the Epstein files. So we'll see what in the end happens. But if I'm Ukraine, one can see this as perhaps a respite from the pressure from Washington to give up the Donbass. But I think it doesn't promise any quick resolution to the war.
The Gulf countries, can you feel them in Washington? I mean, they're absolutely in shock, clearly, Stephen. What sort of representation are they making?
Well, you know, they were very eager to avoid the war to begin with. I mean, they were pushing the Americans very hard to do the negotiation with Iran on a new nuclear deal of some kind. The Gulfies, who had been very wary of Iran and then had been trying to manage Iran and took Iran's power, which was quite real, as a kind of given, and had become closer to Iran, are really quite angry and upset. That's a given. they hope the war will be short because obviously their whole world exists on stability, great airlines, airports, trade, oil going out, oil and gas going out through the Strait of Hormuz. All that is up in the air. So, I mean, they want a quick end to the war. And this was part of the Iranian strategy, which was you attack these allies, you create enough economic pain that they try to get Washington to stop. And that may yet work, by the way. I think Trump is looking at the oil prices and the gasoline prices, even in America, and energy prices, and hearing from the poor Europeans, who everyone convinced them to stop getting cheap Russian energy, and now are reliant on Middle Eastern energy, which is blocked. So there are bigger issues at stake, I think, in terms of the global economy. And with the midterms coming in America in November, I think Trump is still very likely to call an end to this war in the next week or so. Now, I may be totally wrong, but that's the way it feels like it's headed.
We can take bets next time you're on. Stephen Erlanger, thank you for joining Global Roaming.
It was a pleasure. Thank you both for great questions.
Geraldine, I must confess, Stephen Erlanger has a bit of Geraldine Doog about him for me.
Oh, how?
I could listen to the both of you for hours explaining the world to me. It's lulling. I could meditate to it. I could sleep to it, but mostly I'd be informed by it, of course.
Oh, Latika, stop it. Look, I must say I was intrigued by his... Well, there's that sense he's seen a lot, and his sense that it could all end next week.
That was the takeout for me too. And I think he's right, Geraldine. I think we're already seeing hints from Trump on that.
I listened to a fabulous guy with Gideon Rackman in his podcast. This is Emil Hakaim from the Institute of Strategic Studies based in London. And he said, look, there's one thing for sure that you've got to know is neither Israel nor Washington are interested in the day after. They're just, they've got no interest in how Iran goes into the next stage. And it's really hitting me that is the case. So that's going to be for the Iranians to work out, if you know what I mean.
Well, I think we've got a clear divide between what America does and its interests and its metrics that are driving Trump compared to Israel, don't you think? I thought that dichotomy stood out to me in that interview. But you know what else, Geraldine, I thought was really fascinating? Sometimes it takes an outsider to help you see very clearly about yourself. I thought his observation about why Mark Carney and Anthony Albanese have taken the positions they have compared to Europe, and particularly I think the one to compare to is Keir Starmer in the UK, I thought that was really interesting.
Yes, indeed. And we'll just continue to see how this plays out.
Now, Geraldine, last time we were together, we were thinking about going to the cinema. Now, some of our keen listeners have written in about that episode. Darren writes, I really enjoyed your episode about the selling of Warner Brothers to Paramount. However, you missed out on a local reference. Are you aware that Australia's Ten Network is owned by Paramount? That's actually a good point, Geraldine.
It's a very good point indeed. Yes, Channel 10 is a subsidiary of Paramount Skydance's UK and Australia division. So, implications for local media too. If you missed that episode, search for How the MAGA-backed Warner Brothers Deal is a Takeover of American Culture. So, look, tell us what you think. We love hearing from you, global.roaming@abc.net.au. Now, Latika, you're back with Kylie tomorrow. What are you talking about?
A meaty episode, Geraldine. We're looking at the Gen Z takeover of Nepal and how India is reacting to the US sinking of Iran's warship off Sri Lanka's coast. That's 11 a.m, 9 p.m. on Radio National, or anytime on ABC Listen. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.